You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project exploring the prison system by highlighting the voices of those most impacted by prisons. The Prison Voices Project airs on WGXC 90.7 FM Hands-On Community Radio on the first Wednesday of the month from 2 to 3 p.m. You can contact the Prison Voices Project at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me.
Today's program is about youth incarceration. New York State has some of the harshest approaches to young people who commit crimes in the country, allowing teenagers as young as 13 to be given adult-level penalties. Stay tuned to hear about the effects of these laws, including the stories of a young person who spent several years incarcerated at a residential facility in Claverack, and a parent of a young person who has spent most of his adolescence behind bars. But before we delve deeper into youth incarceration, we will give some news updates. Today, at 12:30, a hearing took place in Dutchess County around Proposition Number 2011202, a resolution proposing to expand the Dutchess County Jail. The facility currently holds 292 beds, and a committee is being formed to explore expansion. The committee consists of Chairman of the Legislature Robert G. Rollison, and also includes Sheriff Adrian Butch Anderson and Lieutenant Colonel George Crom, a jail administrator. An organization called Jobs Not Jails organized a press conference to state their opposition to the resolution. According to the group's website, Jobs Not Jails believes in strengthening and revitalizing our community, saving tax dollars, and decreasing the needs for jails by empowering our youth, innovative job creation, education for the incarcerated, and by a comprehensive system of reentry. For more information on Jobs Not Jails, you can visit their website at jobsnotjails.weebly.com. In national news, the Pelican Bay hunger strike finally ended on July 21st after nearly 3 weeks. The prisoners collectively decided to end their strike when presented with an offer by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, meeting at least one of their demands. Those demands included cold weather caps, calendars, and the possibility of some educational opportunities in the secure housing unit. Carol Strickman, a lawyer with legal services for prisoners with children, who spoke by phone with four of the hunger strike leaders, said, "They understand this is a victory, not just because of the concessions that were offered, but because the tremendous international outcry around the conditions at Pelican Bay made it possible to move towards lasting changes for prisoners across California." The strike, which lasted 3 weeks, received broad international support and prompted California lawmakers to initiate hearings on the conditions in the secure housing unit, including the practice of long-term solitary confinement. The Pelican Bay prisoner hunger strike has been one of the largest and longest strikes by prisoners in California history, with more than 6,600 prisoners participating at the height of the strike. Advocates and lawyers will continue to monitor conditions at Pelican Bay State Prison and encourage ongoing review of conditions and confinement in all California prisons. Now we bring you a Prison Voices Project feature on youth incarceration in New York State.
About what you brothers be driving, so I'm gonna tell you a little about what I've been. Struggle and strive for pay that's little more than minimum wage. The cage bird singing away, I feel your pain so I can send it away. Holding on to the promise that the present now assumes to relay, but I still remain a slave to the flesh. That even zest couldn't sanitize when your heart and soul have been vandalized. You couldn't ride for the armor, they couldn't handle mine. And I see your bush without a candle shine. In the middle of dark where people practice the art of nothing less than overcoming the stresses of life. It's like a vice applying pressure to mice. We get squeezed and all act like we ain't needing advice. But it's all in our nature, so I'm knowing that it's real for you. So here's another soul clap to show I feel for you.
Soul clap for all the brothers on lockdown, the brothers on rock. Now with you holding the spot down. For all the ladies who stand up, if you get in your grave up and don't need a man. What? Soul clap. for anybody out to get it. If you hustling and with it, walk about and don't spit it. In a soul, back together we get in a soul. Clap for women and men.
My soul on the surface, lurking through cracks and crevices. Brother, we're merchants. They got brothers trapped, worshiping serpents on the earth, working for pennies. Searching for curses in my verses, but God bless. I manifest, I put this fist to your chest and represent till my flesh is at rest. And when I exit, resurrect through my seeds, connect the words that bleed. The ink from the pen, wrote on the pad, that's word to my mom and dad. Best believe I'm gonna finish this for y'all. I got my mind and my physical, spiritual law. Guiding light on the path through the world system. As I spit these lyrics, released from my vocal structure. Attack the mic like a vulture, highly sculptured like Greek statues. When I smash through the streets with the MIC in my hands, more plans to pinch in my ascension like the ribbon in the sky. I'm living just enough to get by. Lord, I try.
Get a soul clap for all the brothers on lockdown, the brothers on rocks. Now with you holding the spot down, hold that. For all the ladies who stand up, if you get in your grains up and don't need a man. Get a soul clap for anybody out to get it. If you hustling and waiting, walk about and don't spit it. In a soul clap, back together we get. So clap for women and men.
Yeah, mama was good to me. Daddy was great too. Growing up was newish and helped me to grow like steak do. I'm in the lake deep up, but I'm trying to paddle back. High tide is rowing, I'm sowing flow in a Cadillac. I'm really an expedition, but I keep my hopes high. Reaching for my dreams as I travel, watching them float by. I feel so sad, it's real, congrats to ya. Either got you stuck in the city or they blasting ya. Cases pending on these cops harassing ya. Surviving my country, yo, it's back to Africa. Master, yeah, they want the blood like Dracula. Hot spots downtown, feel me, I'm backing up. Sissy tell me I'm cracking up. Head high, look to the sky. Hey, yo, that's what's up. Soul clapping, just another brother that's rapping. Like I told you before, it's time for some
can
action.
Can I get a soul clap for all the brothers on lockdown, the brothers on rocks. Now with you holding the spot
can
down,
I get a hold that.
For all the ladies who stand up, if you get in your grains up and don't need a man. Can I get a soul clap for anybody out to get it. If you hustling and waiting, walk about and don't spit it. In a soul clap, back together we get in a soul clap for women and men.
He wrote me a letter, and he told me he was sorry for him being away so long. And I had to tell him, it's not your fault. He said, I had to grow up and, you know, incarcerated. He's been incarcerated ever since the age of 14, and he's 19 now. And he'll be almost 20 when he come home. And that's a long time for me, and yeah, I'm just be depressed a lot because I miss my son. It's like he had to raise himself in jail. It's hard. It's real hard. And I miss my son. And now I have another one that is going through the same thing.
Prior to 1978, the cases of all children under 16 years of age, regardless of the severity of the crime, were exclusively within the jurisdiction of the family court, where they could be placed for no more, if they were found guilty of the offense, where they would be adjudicated juvenile delinquents, and placed for no more than 5 years or until they reached the age of 21, but in any event, the end result of that was they would not be criminalized. They would be considered juvenile delinquents. And this was even for the crime of murder. And that's how Willie Boskett's case became such a sensational one, an extraordinary one, and really was the basis for politicians and the public through the media's attention to the Willie Boskett case, because Willie Boskett murdered two people before he reached the age of 16. And when the public became aware, now wait a minute, now Willie Boskett is going to go into the family court?
Retired Judge Michael Corriero runs an organization devoted to treating children as children in New York's court system. He was a judge in the New York State courts for 28 years.
So Willie Boskett precipitated the enactment of New York's juvenile offender law. And that law essentially criminalized 13, 14, and 15-year-olds for behavior that prior to 1978 would have been considered delinquent behavior and would have subjected them to the therapeutic interventions available in the family court. And instead, now these children were going into an adult court, which was ill-equipped to deal with the developmental differences of children and had very little flexibility in terms of therapeutic interventions that were available through the family court.
We spoke with Nancy Ginsberg, who is the director of the Adolescent Intervention and Diversion Team at New York City's Legal Aid Society, the city's largest public defender agency. Nancy's team represents young people charged as adults.
The vast, vast majority of the crimes charged are robberies in the first or second degree, and those are usually robberies with weapons or physical injury, caused almost always by a group of kids acting together. The kids in the city tend to come from the same neighborhoods, very underserviced, poor neighborhoods. There are a number of neighborhoods in each county that tend to feed the system. Many of our kids have mental health issues and learning disabilities, emotional disturbances. They have fractured family structures. And the vast, vast majority of the kids are kids of color.
My crime, personally, my crime was I went to the store, but I had a BB gun. I didn't have a real gun. I had a BB gun. You know, it looked real, and the purpose of it, the intent of it was to be used as a, you know, to be perceived as a real gun, but it wasn't real. But I got charged with a robbery. Originally, I got charged with robbery in the first degree, armed robbery, I mean, in the first degree. You know what I mean?
James is now 19 years old. He was arrested when he was just 15. He was sent to Brookwood, a 180-bed secure residential facility for 13, 14, and 15-year-olds charged as adults, or so-called juvenile offenders, who are charged under the law which Judge Corriero previously described. The facility is located in Columbia County. James describes a day in the life of the facility.
You know, you wake up, you go to class, learn nothing. Yeah, after that, you may go to gym, but, you know, it's not really much. It's about 45 minutes or so of, you know, whatever you choose to do. And go back on the wing, you know, you watch TV or playing cards or, you know, just have a lot of free time, just sitting, you know, doing nothing. Or, you know, if that, and that's only if they choose to let you do that. Because they can, you know, and they have just kept you in a cell where you're just looking out the window, you know, sitting on your bed, sleeping, or whatever the case is, you know, doing nothing except thinking about how you're going to, you know, the negative things you're going to do when you come out. Because, you know, when you're locked in a cell, you're like, you know, why do I care? Why should I not do negative things? I'm already in a cell, you know what I mean? It's just, this is boring. I'd rather have some action. Let me go outside. Let me start a fight. You know, let me get everybody going crazy. This is going to be fun, you know? That's the things that you know, residents think about, because they feel like if you're gonna, you know, force them to do nothing, then they'll make something happen, you know. But I feel like if they were all the time, 100% of the time, active and, you know, their time was occupied with other things, they wouldn't have time to think about negative things to do, because they'll be playing sports, you know, whatever, basketball, baseball, football, you know, football at 1, baseball at 3, soccer at 6, whatever it is, you know, and then, you know, maybe a movie at 8, whole days occupied. So at the end of the day, you're just tired, you're ready to go to sleep, you know, you're not thinking about anything else, you know. But don't relax people so they can have the energy to just wild out all day, you know what I mean? Which is what happened. You know, I remember times when 10 o'clock at night, when everybody was supposed to go to sleep, people start banging on their doors, you know, and going crazy, cursing, yelling. They're full of energy, you know. They don't, you know, they don't have nothing to do, and that's how it was.
Pam has seen both of her sons and her husband go behind bars. All three of them were charged as juvenile offenders. Pam lives in Harlem, where she raises her family and attends college.
This is a month. First of all, you just throw them in jail instead of trying to help them. Maybe you could send them to a program. Maybe they can get therapy. Maybe they just need someone to talk to. I don't think jail is the outcome of everything. I really don't. I see a lot of young people go in and they come out worse than what they were. I think that's what makes you a bad person. I really do. I mean, sometimes you have to give a person a chance. Sometimes it could be a mistake.
Elsie Chandler is a senior trial attorney at the Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem, a community-based defender office. She runs the Youth Law Project there, which focuses on providing high-quality legal representation to young people charged with crimes. Much of her work is with young people charged as adults. She is also a licensed clinical psychologist. She has been working in Harlem for over 40 years.
Any prison is inherently stultifying, inherently dehumanizing, brutalizing. It's just in the nature of the institution. And I know that there are some people who work in prisons and in juvenile facilities who are remarkable human beings. I've met them, I've talked to them, I know that that happens. But I'm saying that institutionally, it's not good.
A 2009 study by the Office of Children and Family Services, or OCFS, the state agency responsible for providing residential treatment for young people adjudicated as juvenile delinquents and charged as juvenile offenders, revealed that 89% of the young men released from OCFS custody were rearrested by the age of 28.
Because the recidivism rate, as far as I know when I was in there, was 85%. And in my 2.5 years there, I seen, you know, people go home, violate parole, violate probation, come back. You know, it's like a cycle because, you know, they come out. When they're sent out, they're sent out with nothing. You understand what I'm saying? They may max out or whatever the case is, CR out, and they're on the street, but they don't have no job. They don't have no resources to help them with a job. They have no resources to help them with school. They basically said, okay, you just spent 2 years here. Now try again. You know, and, it's going to fail. Because you don't, you know, you're basically going from an environment where you have no freedom to an environment where you have all the freedom you need. You know, and even me as myself, even with all I had, I found it difficult. You know, they gave me a ticket. I still have my ticket, you know, for the Amtrak. You know, and I'm like, that this ticket is just a ticket. Some people, to me, it's like, this day I came home, this day they put me on the train on my own to, you know, try again. So, you know, but I knew that try again, I wasn't going to fail. You know, I'm going to try again and I'm going to succeed, you know, but I sat that ticket and, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, I may be able to succeed with this kind of situation, you know, because I feel like I'm a strong individual, you know, who has basically been on my own mostly all my life. So I'm prepared for it. You know, I've always been independent, but not many people know how to be independent. You know, they always, if they don't have somebody, they're going to fail. So, you know, I feel like, you know, I understand when people come out, they don't have nothing, why they fail.
What were you most scared about when you were on that train ride?
Well, one of the things was just communicating with people. You know, I've just been, for the past 2.5 years, I've been communicating with this type of, you know, environment, these type of people who, you know, all you hear is explicit language and disrespect towards other people, you know, and all these types of things. And then, you know, you're on the train, you see, you know, I'm looking to my right, the guy's reading a newspaper, to the left, ladies on the computer, you know, I'm just talking to them, like, hey, how you doing, you know, like, I'm in shock, like, and then I'm looking at the train, I see, you know, these trees, you know, just, it's like, wow, you know, and I'm just like, when I get off this train, I have to get on the next, on my own. You know, when I get off that train, I take the bus on my own. You know, when I get home, I want to eat something, I have to get the food on my own, you know.
Young people who are charged as adults often face a term on adult parole after they've been released on custody. This often means that they're on parole when they're as young as 15 years old. Young people who are released onto parole typically have a nightly curfew and are expected to participate in a variety of substance abuse and anger management programs. However, parole officers in New York are notorious for their focus on surveillance and monitoring, not on support and care.
Parole, okay, parole I feel is no help at all, because I came home on parole. All parole did for me was come to my house a couple times a week, maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, 6 a.m, wake me up just to see if I'm home and leave. Then, you know, at first when I came home, I had to report to the office every week, then every 2 weeks, then every month. And they would give me a urine test, see if I'm clean, have a nice day. You know, that's basically it.
Pam's oldest son spent time in a secure residential facility operated by OCFS and was released onto parole when he was just 15 years old. He was rearrested just a few short months later.
I have a son that's in Green Correctional Facility now, but my experience with parole when he first came home, it was unfair to me. It was unfair. They didn't explain nothing to my son. He was only 15 when he came home. He was on adult parole, and they treated him like he was an adult. You know, they just threw him out there in the streets. Around my area where I live, it is so bad. It is so bad. Police harass you all the time around here. He came home, the day he came home, he went to the store, and he was harassed the same day. He came outside maybe like 5 days after he was home. He got arrested because he was on a bike on the corner. They violated him. They said he was with the gang around here, which he was going to know anything about what was going on around here. So when he came home, it's like they just sweep him up. So now my son is incarcerated again to next year, to 2012.
A criminal conviction weighs heavily in an individual and their family's lives. Unless they are given the opportunity to receive what is called youthful offender treatment, which is granted under limited circumstances relating to the nature of the offense, a young person charged as an adult will have a conviction on their record for life. This impacts their ability to apply for college, for jobs, and for housing. They cannot vote while they are incarcerated or on parole, nor can they serve on a jury. A criminal conviction can trigger deportation proceedings, even for those who are legal permanent residents, green card holders, or asylum seekers.
You can't live in public housing if you're convicted of a felony. You get your grandmother kicked out of her public housing because you're living with your grandmother. You got yourself involved in some drug offense or other criminal behavior at 16 years of age or 15 years of age or 17 years of age. So there are the collateral consequences of these youthful convictions. Significantly inhibit New York teenagers from transcending their youthful mistakes, and I think that's something that we need to look at and we need to address, and we need to make people aware of.
What are other kinds of obstacles that he kind of faced when he got out and tried to get back on his feet again?
Like I said, it was hard. He couldn't get a job. He really couldn't get into school. Basically, he couldn't do anything. It's like once you go inside a incarceration, you can't get a job. It's hard to get a job. So, I mean, sometimes you just lead them back to the streets to do the same thing that they were doing. I think it should be something done better than what it is with the system. Incarceration is not the best answer. It's not. I mean, sometimes, just like you want to put them in jail, mandate them to go to school, mandate them to get a job, mandate them to go to a program. You're taking all the programs from these kids. You're taking the community centers from these kids. You're taking the jobs from these kids. What is left for them to do besides be outside, fighting against one another, or going to jail? I mean, come on, we have to make things more better. And as parents, it takes more than two or three parents, you know, to do something. But if we all can't get together, this is what's going to happen to our children. It's going to stay the same way.
A number of young people charged with crimes in New York have experienced trauma and brutality in their lives. And recent figures indicate that 58% of young people admitted to OCFS custody are screened as having mental health needs. In 2010, the United States Department of Justice released the results of an investigation in which they found severely inadequate mental health care within the facilities which they investigated.
One of the frustrating things for us was there wasn't a single mental health organization that was available for young offenders who presented with these incipient mental health issues. And I say in sympathy is because one of the things I learned from our psychological staff is that a 14 or 15-year-old doesn't necessarily have these full-blown indicia or symptoms where a psychiatrist or psychologist can say, well, yes, this young person has this ailment or that ailment. They were in the beginning stages very often and were at the point where they could be successfully addressed because they were so young. So it was the early intervention that was crucial. And we didn't have any resources to place these young people. Not only were there very few institutions available for these young people, but we had no statutory authority to sentence a young person who had mental health issues that may have indicated they were more mentally challenged than delinquent, if you will. And it was, we couldn't place any of these young people in those institutions that were available if they had gone through the family court because we had no funding stream. My only option as a judge in terms of dealing with juvenile offender cases was a sentence of imprisonment, incarceration in an OCFS facility, where at the time that I was resolving it, there wasn't a single psychiatrist available, and there wasn't a single institution that was devoted exclusively to dealing with the mental health issues under the auspices of the Office of Children and Families, or grant probation, which was which itself was not capable of providing the kind of services that many of these young people had. So whereas the same young person, had they been in the family court setting, would have had an exhaustive psychiatric diagnostic assessment that would have evaluated the facts that led to the commission of the offense in the context of a mental health issue, and a youth who had a significant mental health could be placed in a civil institution, get the kind of treatment that they needed, or placed with a psychiatrist and get the kind of counseling. And this was all authorized, and therefore these institutions or facilities that provided these services had a funding stream to maintain them. None of that was available to us in the adult court for 14 and 15-year-olds being prosecuted as adults, as well as 16 and 17-year-old adolescents.
OCFS has recently introduced a trauma-centered treatment model called the Sanctuary Model into some of its facilities. This program was introduced in part to try to produce safer environments in residential care and to acknowledge the stressors that young people and staff experience in confinement. Yet there are some who question whether programs like this can be adequately implemented in environments where young people are also sent as a form of punishment.
It's not a secret that mental health services are sorely lacking in our society, and too often what passes for supposed mental health services are not at all helpful. Not at all human, not at all empathic. It's kind of, sometimes it's even more terrible than prison. Going to somebody who says that they're going to help you, and in fact doesn't help you at all, just simply holds you in contempt, hates you, treats you disrespectfully, and at the same time says that they're a helping person.
The individual capacity to change, grow up, and grow out of crime is one which has been examined by scholars and philosophers alike. Pam and Judge Corriero weigh in on this question.
My son was kind of a bad kid. When he was here in Rikers Island, he fought all the time. He stayed in the box. So he kept saying, I want to hurry up and go upstate. And I used to always wonder, why are you telling me that? Why do you want to go upstate? I don't want you to go nowhere. He said, it's better for me. So now he's going to school for his GED. He's doing electrical. And he's not getting into no trouble. He said, I want to come home, and I'm going to do what I have to do for you and myself you can't just do it for me. I want you to do it for you. So he said, I got to do it for you too because I hurt you a lot. But my thing is, as long as you come home to me in one piece, you can stay inside 24 hours a day. You can stay on the telephone all day as long as you're here with me. But I really, really believe this time in my heart that he has learned. He really has learned.
From your perspective as a judge, what do you think some people might find surprising about this place that's sitting in their community, that something that would surprise them about the group of young people that are sitting in the facility?
Well, if, for example, they had an opportunity to talk to some of these young people, they would be impressed with their immaturity. And to think that we're not viewing these young people from their perspective as unfinished and not viewing them from the perspective of we as society having a responsibility to fully educate them, to provide the therapeutic interventions that are so necessary for them to mature into constructive members of society. I think one of the things that I was surprised, perhaps surprised is too strong a word, but one of the things that constantly presented itself to me when I was resolving the case of many of these young people, it is their capacity to change, given appropriate intervention. That most young offenders were not completely wedded to a path of criminality. That those of us who were working with them were challenged by the level of issues that many of them had, but they were still malleable. And I think the malleability of young offenders is one of the things that our system has lost sight of in terms of how we're dealing with them, and that the children are less wedded to their behavior as perhaps an adult who has been a repetitive offender and is on a path that's much more difficult to help them walk away from.
We asked James how he felt about charging teenagers as adults.
I don't feel like the system is correct with the way they process kids, because you're charging a 16-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever, 16-year-old as adults. You know, you could be charged with this guy, this 16-year-old, with the same crime and the same time as you're charging this 30-year-old with, when the 30-year-old has, you know, 14 more years of experience in life. You know, he's a lot older, more different, you know, more mature, or where his mind is. You know, a 6-year-old, like I said, they think they know everything, like I thought. They, you know, you think you know everything, but you don't. So, you know, you're going to a store like I did. You know, you're robbing the store thinking it's nothing. You'll be home, you know, maybe tomorrow, or, you know, maybe at 12 o'clock the next day, but you end up doing, you know, 2.5 years. You know, you don't think about these things because you're not at the age where you should be. You don't have that kind of responsibility where you're, you know, your mind is used to that kind of, you know, upgrade, you know, that kind of high, you know, value. So I feel like, you know, at that age there should be different resources, you know. And then after that point, you know, once you get older and then you're 25, 30, 35, whatever the case is, and you keep doing that, then that's on you. You had your chance, you know, you had your opportunity, you had your, you know, your get a jail card, but now you didn't learn, then that's on you. But first, I believe that as a youth, you should be given the opportunity to learn and to have that second chance. Then from automatically, you're doomed. Now you have to, basically, it's that much harder for you, you know, before you're even a grown man. You know, before you're even 18, you're already struggling just with your record, you know?
There was this study undertaken through the auspices of the MacArthur Foundation, which compared a significant number of young offenders of the same age who committed the same offense and essentially came from similar backgrounds, both in New Jersey and in New York. And the study concluded that the children who were prosecuted in New Jersey, where the age of criminal responsibility was 18, were prosecuted essentially in the juvenile court context, as compared to the children in New York who were prosecuted in the adult court for their offenses. 86% more kids were rearrested than those in New Jersey. But I look at it from this point of view. If you're a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old who takes the ferry from Hoboken to downtown New York, somehow by that voyage do you acquire the sophistication and maturity of an adult? Because if you're 14 and you land at Wall Street and you get yourself involved in any criminal behavior that amounts to a juvenile offender offense, you're going to be in the adult court and you're going to face a criminal conviction. Simultaneously, there were a number of independent foundations and research institutions that were looking at the efficacy of trying children as adults. And there were some very significant studies demonstrating that trying children as adults simply is not a constructive response to juvenile offending. Indeed, it was carcinogenic in the sense that young people who were tried as adults were more likely to reoffend than young people who were kept in the juvenile court, and more likely to reoffend in violent ways than young people whose cases were handled in the juvenile court. And the idea of stigmatizing 14, 15, and 16-year-old kids with a criminal record or stigmatizing them as criminal became a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you will, because young people who incurred a record at such an early age were unlikely to be able to overcome the impediments to employment, gainful employment, to education, to get out from under this conception that society had of them, that they were criminals.
While there are a growing network of alternative to incarceration programs that exist in New York, and a substantial number of young people who are charged as juvenile delinquents in family court and who have been able to stay at home, there are few alternatives for young people charged as adults.
Like, when I was younger, it always was something for the kids to do. You can go to the schools, you can go to the PAL, you can go anywhere and have something to do. Nowadays, it's nothing. All these abandoned buildings around here, why you can't make something for the kids to keep them off the streets? Instead of that supermarket you built on the corner, that should have been a community center. It's a lot of kids over in this community that needs to get off the street. And they're not going to go anywhere because we don't have nothing to do but stand on the corner all the time. Every day. You probably go out there now and see them on the corner.
So let's say City of New York gave you $1 million to help kids that kind of from in similar situations that you were when you were, say, 13, 14, 15. What would you do with that $1 million?
The first thing I would do is I would look at a lot of people that were in my situation that I know, you know, as far as the people I know right now that are successful, I would get them together. Then I would ask them to get people they know. And I'll just do extensive research on people who have been locked up for robbery, people locked up for murder, people locked up for different types of things, and who are home now successfully with doing these things as a youth, you know, and they made it. And I would want them to be with me working on, you know, different ideas, you know, because I don't know everything, and I don't have, you know, one thing that I know, someone else may not, but they might know a lot more than I don't, and their ideas may be a lot better than mine. So I feel like if you put in a room all, you know, let's say 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds, whatever it is, 23-year-olds, all, you know, youth that went through these experiences for different crimes, you know, they know what it's like, they know how they were treated, they know what could have been better, they know what could have been worse, they know what it is. If you put them together and just everybody's brains just work together, then I feel like, you know, that would be the main ingredient, you know, the main recipe to what works. You know, what would be the ideal plan to help youths? Because, like I said, I can't think of what would help because, I haven't been charged with everything. I don't know, have every, you know, every crime, what the time is. I don't know how you're treated, if you do this, if you do that. I just know my crime, robbery. You know, I want to speak to somebody who's been locked up for murder. I want to see, you know, what they feel like, you know, what was their situation. Somebody, you know, that was locked up, you know, for assault or criminal possession of a gun. Why were you holding a gun? You know, were you scared? There wasn't enough protection for you in your environment? You know, what is it? So I feel like if you put all these people in one room, that's what I would do. The first thing is that $1 million, I'd be like, listen, I'm paying you. Get your ass over here. Let's work on this. This is what we need to do. You know what I mean? It would be like a foundation, you know. You know, who knows? I might call it the recipe. You know, whatever it is. That would be the foundation to, you know, starting what works. Or it could be called what works. You know what I mean?
A recent report by the Community Service Society found that only 7% of the 200,000 disconnected 16 to 24-year-olds in New York City were served by existing educational and job training programs. And there are an estimated 12,000 program slots available to serve this group. According to an article in City Limits magazine about this issue, recent census data shows that 173,000 17 to 24-year-olds in New York, that's 18% of the population, are neither in school nor working, the highest ratio in the country.
If there was a program that, you know, contained, you know, similar youth that had things in common, but not as far as, you know, not a program that's focused on just keeping you locked down. A program that, you know, maybe a type of recreational thing that is based on straight, you know, education, sports. You know, you go to this place, you know, you're basically playing sports all day. Then you're, you know, in school all day. You don't have time to think about fighting. You don't have time to think about, you know, anything. And, you know, I agree with having classes about, you know, explaining what you did was wrong. You know, a little social work, a one-on-one thing. Why did you do what it was wrong? You know, this is what you should have done, whatever the case is. But I feel like it should be more extensively explained, you know, teaching people what are their other options when they get to that kind of situation. Like, you know, if you have, you know, these 10 youth who were locked up for robbery because they didn't have no other, they feel like they didn't have no other option at the time, they needed money, they were put in this situation and they had no choice, well then put them together and put them in a group and let them talk about, you know, each one, why, you know, you know, maybe you needed money for food or you needed money, you know, just to get by, whatever the case was, and then explain to them, well, you know, this is what you could have done. You know, you could have, at 15, maybe this place is a, you know, have a kind of program that employs 15-year-olds, you know, because a lot of people won't, you know, there's not many jobs for 15, you know, 16-year-olds, and then, you know, you have nothing but free time on your hand, you know. So, you know, I feel like, okay, you prove to society that you can't have full freedom by, you know, committing a crime. So, but don't lock up the youth and teach them, you know, the most negative things possible. You know, teach them, you know, if they can't educate themselves on their own, then I feel you should educate them, you know, in an environment that's, you know, somewhat, I guess, regulated or so. But
structured,
yeah, that's what I mean, structured, you know, but not to the extent where, you know, everyone is just going against each other, and it's that kind of a negative environment. Because people are not going to listen. People are not going to want to, you know, do what you tell them to do. They're going to just do whatever they want to do regardless. If I had $1 million, I would definitely, that's one of the things I would also do, is set up many, many employment agencies who only hire that age, you know, whatever, 13 to 16, whatever it is, just a certain age group that they only hire, so that, you know, all these kids know that, you know, I'm not going from place to place for applications. I come here, they'll find it, you know, they'll help me find it, or, you know, I can work here, whatever it is. And if there's a certain job that they're not fully trained for, well, let's train them, you know what I mean? Let's equip them with the knowledge they need, so that once, you know, they can work at that job, whatever it is, maintenance or buffing floors or painting, you know, start them young. Start them, you know, learning trades young, so that by the time they get 16, 17, 18, 19, they're already having good jobs. They're already making, you know, enough money so that they don't need to commit a robbery, you know what I mean? If you know people like like rapping, like hip-hop, like music. Well, use that to your advantage. Make a program like that. You know, don't do what you think people like. Do what you know they like. So, you know, if people like music, start a music group. You know, if people like painting, start a painting group. Whatever it is, don't, you know, have a chess group because you think they like that. You know what I mean? So I think, you know, and actually writing lyrics is a very, very good way to, you know, express your emotions, how you feel, and, you know, get all that anger and frustration and stress out of you so that, you know, you're like, wow, I just, you know, had this big burden on my shoulder, and I was just, I feel so light, you know. And I feel like, you know, the main thing is, like I said, using what you know the residents like to their, you know, to your advantage. Do that because you'll know they like it, and you know, if you want to mix it up some way with, in a learning way, you know, if it's music, you want to talk about hip-hop history, you know, things like that, because people be interested in that, you know, people will be interested in what happened to Biggie, you know, what happened to the history of that, what happened exactly, you know, things like that. So I think that's how it should be.
What should be done? We asked everyone what they thought were our obligations to young people under these laws in New York.
I think that we have to mount a campaign to have our public officials appreciate the enormity of this issue and its impact on New York children. We recognize that the great weight of these laws that criminalize young people under 18 years that fall most often on the poor and the vulnerable in our communities, communities throughout the state. And yet, I don't believe that legislators who are otherwise sensitive to the economic issues that the barriers created by these laws, as well as recognizing the true value of children in our society.
We live in a very brutal society, and a society where the predominant culture is violent, not just the subculture that the young adults that I represent live in, but the predominant culture is violent. I'm not talking about just movies and video games. I'm talking about, after all, we live in a society right now that's waging war in multiple areas all over the world. This kind of society, this kind of violence, economic violence, the stark contrast in some people being enormously rich and the bulk of people being increasingly poor, losing their homes, losing their jobs, not being able to find a job that gives you a living wage, even if you do find a job. These are violences that we all live with. And children suffer the most, actually. Children suffer when their parents suffer. Children suffer the uncertainty, the fear, hunger, deprivations of poverty. Children suffer. And if you grow up suffering and being brutalized, that's what you learn. You become an angry person, a person filled with despair, a person who doesn't always act with empathy towards the next person. It's not just, for example, my client that might lack empathy. It's the state that lacks empathy. We are actually, all of us in this, a community of victims. It's very bad for, it's very humanly unsatisfying for the prosecution and for the court to lack empathy towards my clients, just as it is bad for my clients to lack empathy towards, let's say, the person whose bicycle they're taking.
Several months ago, James was asked to give a speech at his foster care agency. He read from a paper that he wrote for college, for which he received an A.
Exiting the elementary school backyard to walk home, the sight of fellow students running into their parents' arms was a yearning unfillable for me. During award ceremonies, families made up of a mother, father, brother, sister, and baby were always present, clapping and representing support to their loved ones. Standing alone, my eyes were stuck on the empty seat in the back row. A coldness struck my heart and tears overcame my eyes. Moving to several diverse households with various babysitters throughout my early childhood would leave the idea of stability and family absent from my mind. Lack of discipline and of consequences would make me disobedient to authority. This false sense of reality, the only reality I saw at the time, led to continuous school suspensions, no employment, and repeated police contact. Overall, an undesirable portrait of life. Having no intent to work, money was a necessity that I was willing to obtain by any means. On that summer day in July 2007, walking into a gift shop and holding the cashier at gunpoint, I was left with $800 in my pocket for 30 minutes and a cell with a metal bed for 2.5 years. This was the end of false knowledge playing its part and the beginning of reality stepping in. While serving my sentence in an environment where we are nothing more than a number in space, reality struck. I knew that the present me was not the real me. Reading books, obtaining my GED, taking college courses, and working for 50 cents an hour showed me responsibility and that there was still hope. Viewing and feeling the lack of freedom was a pain that fueled my blood to be a success and prove all those who doubted me that they were wrong, including myself. Coming home was a feeling nearly unexplainable and not believable for a long time, but I wasted not 1 minute. I found employment quickly, entered college, and began restoration into society day by day. My mindset was that of a positive person. Work hard, earn everything I achieve, with 105% effort put into it, have a family, and be viewed as a success while knowing how true that really is. Ultimately, being content and happy through my actions in life and knowing that I made it was and is my goal. It took all this time for me to realize that I've always wanted this feeling but never had the idea of what it was and how it was obtained. Through the necessary ordeal of prison, my viewpoint has been clarified and my knowledge vastly increased. The before was missing it, the present is making it, the future holds it. My American dream.
Advocates around the state are beginning to discuss the possibility of raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York. For those of you who are interested in learning more about this issue, go to the website of the New York Center for Juvenile Justice, Judge Corriero's organization. Other organizations involved in this issue statewide are the Institute for Juvenile Justice Reform and Alternatives, based in Brooklyn, the Correctional Association, and the Children's Defense Fund of New York, based in Manhattan, Youth Power, based in Albany, and the Center for Community Alternatives, based in Syracuse and Brooklyn.
There's an old friend that I once heard say something that touched my heart, and it began there. I was born by the river in a little tent, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come. Oh yeah. He said it's been too. What was up there beyond the sky?
Special thanks to Jeremy Thal and Alexandra Cox for this program. You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project exploring the prison system by highlighting the voices of those most impacted by prisons. The Prison Voices Project airs the first Wednesday of the month from 2 to 3 p.m. If you have feedback about the program that you have just heard, you can email feedback@wgxc.org. If you're interested in sharing your stories or ideas or in getting involved, you can write to us at The Prison Voices Project, 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free.
Hey, it's Nanu Badilla, aka Nanu. Listen to WGXC.